So good afternoon, everyone. I got a green light here. That's off. I'm on?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe just took a minute then. So happy Sabbath, everyone, and welcome to any visitors we have here. I'm speaking on the 7 days of creation, which this is not my first time speaking. I had to count how many times it's been now, but I believe this is my fifth time up here. It's a big topic to cover, and so I'm going to go ahead and get right into it. To start with, though, I will kind of recap everything a little bit briefly here. I think maybe the batteries are out on this one here. It was on for the moment then. Yeah, I pushed the green button and then it came on, but now nothing's happening. There's no power to it. No. Which might be okay, because I can just have you guys do the slides manually if need be.
If we can't get it working.
Maybe that was it. I was just pushing the green button.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Okay, so let me try. Oh, I think it's trying to catch up here. There we go. Okay, I think I'm ready now. Okay, so I started off the very first time talking, just I started off with the whole relevance of Genesis and kind of why I'm up here, taking my time with it, not rushing through it. And so with each time I get up to speak, I want to bring us back to the whole point of this is that the reason why we're going over this is because Genesis is the foundation for our beliefs, and all doctrine is derived from Genesis. And so it's very important for us as Christians to have a good understanding of what's going on with Genesis. And then I went and talked a little bit about your worldview and how important it is for us to have a biblical worldview as opposed to any other kind of worldview. And the reason for that is because your worldview shapes how you think and therefore what your actions are. And so Genesis and your worldview are deeply entwined together, and it's important for us to realize that. I spent a good portion of my message going over the age of the world, talking about the different theories out there, whether or not we live in a relatively young Earth, approximately about 6,000 years old, or whether our Earth is hundreds of millions or billions of years old. And there's a lot of different theories out there. We went through all these different ones. I spent a lot of time talking about the gap theory. In fact, I devoted pretty much a whole message talking about the gap theory, going into detail with that, the scriptures that go along with it. And I spend a lot of time doing that just because in the Church of God culture, it's a very popular theory. A lot of people believe in the gap theory and whatnot. So I took some time with that. And I've also kind of interjected in my messages different topics of science. And so with my first message, I talked about the nature of time, how time is a physical dimension that we live in. But God is not confined to that physical dimension. He's outside of that. He's in the spiritual realm. And so that is kind of interesting to look at that and some examples. Then I went on and I gave a message all on day one and day two. Day one, creation of light. And we spent some time just talking about the science behind light, getting into some quantum physics even, the duality of is light a particle or is it a wave? And it's an interesting paradox when you look at that and the science behind it. I talked a little bit about the speed of light. And then from there, we went into and talked about day two, which is, in my opinion, probably the most difficult day to understand because of the wording there, talking about the firmament and the waters above the firmament, the waters below the firmament, and that the firmament is heaven. So we looked at all those words, we looked at the Hebrew behind those, and we looked at a lot of different theories out there on what it could mean. So And then last time I spoke, I actually started off going through a few chapters in Job. Near the end of Job, starting in chapter 38, God gives Job a science quiz. And so that kind of goes along with Genesis. I believe it's 70-some questions that God poses to Job about science. And so we briefly spent some time going through that, looking at some of those questions and relating it back to Genesis. And then from there, we went into day three. And that's kind of exciting because that's the first time that God creates life, plant life on earth. And we got into talking about cells and some of the science behind that, the myth of the simple cell, that cells are not simple at all, but they're very complex. In fact, everything that God has created has great complexity to it. And so I talked a little bit about how to dispel the myth of the simple cell and just the miracle behind that, along with the biology of the cell, photosynthesis, and all that. We spent just a little bit of time. And then on day four, talking about when God created the sun, moon, and stars, we got into talking a little bit about the Big Bang Theory, where that came from, how that's changed over the years, and still even today, the math behind the Big Bang Theory doesn't work, and so they have major issues with it, but yet they teach it as fact to us in schools and in society. Talked a little bit about the nebular hypothesis, which is the belief or the theory that all our planets in our solar system came out of the sun. And so if you believe in evolution, then if you think about it that way, we're made from the sun as well, because our Earth came out of the sun. And so you'll hear prominent evolutionist scientists out there that will say we're nothing but stardust. And so if you've ever heard that before, that's where it comes from. And talked about the anthropic principle, which is interesting. Anthropic principle, basically, in a nutshell, are all the parameters that are needed for there to be life on Earth. And some 50 years ago, Carl Sagan said that there's only two parameters necessary to have life on a planet. And so as a result of that and other scientists claiming this, they went out to find extraterrestrial life on other planets, spending, I don't know how many millions of taxpayer dollars, and private funds too, but a lot of taxpayer dollars trying to find extraterrestrial life, which they still do to this day, still spend their tax dollars for. Even though now that list of two parameters has grown to over 200 parameters. And not only that, but there's the Goldilocks principle, which means each one of these parameters, it can't be too little or too much. It has to be just right. And that margin of error for a lot of these parameters are very small. And so if you put all that together, it makes the chances of life on another planet just absurd. And there's even people who have done like calculations to show mathematically how absurd that number would be, but yet we still spend money on trying to find extraterrestrial life. And then I just spent a few minutes or a little bit of time talking about the constellations. There are verses in the Bible that talk about the constellations, and there is a theory out there. It's completely speculative, but it's something interesting to perhaps study about how the different constellations, the theory is that the constellations spell out the gospel message. And so it's just something interesting that I pointed out and something you can study on your own if you want to. So here I have a little chart showing the 7 days of creation. We've been through days one through four. Today, actually last night, I was putting together everything I have in sequential order and everything. And I kind of timed out how long it would take. And I think I have like an hour and a half left to like finish everything. So it's like still like a little bit too long. And I don't want to like necessarily skip anything or leave anything out, because I think it's all pretty good, I think, anyways. And so I think I'm probably just going to cut it like right in half. So, and today I'm going to basically take all of day five and half of day six, talking about all the living creatures, excluding the creation of man and woman, and talk about that today. So that's what I have. Okay, so if you want to open your Bibles to Genesis, and the point we're at here is Genesis 1, verse 20. Genesis 1, verse 20. Then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. And one thing I want to kind of point out here at this point that I don't think I've pointed out yet is as we go along through the week of creation, a lot of people, a lot of commentaries will even say that as the week progresses, there's increasing perfection in what God is making. So not to belittle like what God has already created on days 1 through 4, but I tend to agree with that, that now here God is making even something that's more perfect with actually having a creature that he's making. And of course, it's all leading up to God's perfect creation, which is creation of man and woman. So just something interesting to point out. Then verse 21, so God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded, according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was very good, or saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. So the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And I'm going to actually continue on, going into the sixth day now, because I'm going to kind of combine these two. So verse 24, then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Okay, so there's the creation of all the creatures that we have on earth. And another topic that I talked about last time, and last time I spoke, there weren't a lot of people here. I know there was a funeral, and so a lot of people kind of missed this. But one concept I want to talk about again, and this kind of applies to everything else I'm talking about now through the end of Genesis, is the whole idea of irreducible complexity. And I know a lot of you have already know about irreducible complexity, so it'll be like a review. But for anyone that may not, the definition I have up on the screen. Irreducible complexity is a single system which is composed of several interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, and where removal of any one of these parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. And that's kind of a technical definition. So the easiest way I find of explaining it is to kind of give you an example. And the classic example is that of a mousetrap. And a mousetrap, you can use it as an analogy, can be like any living biological system. And a mousetrap, it has several parts, as you can see on the screen up here. And each one of those parts you need in order to have a mousetrap. For instance, if you take away that hammer, the mousetrap won't work. Or if you take away the spring, the mousetrap won't work. Any of those parts, if you take it away, it's not going to work, right? And you can liken this to a lot of examples out there with biological systems. And the kind of the classic example would be that of the little tail on a cell. They call a flagellum. This is a close-up picture of that tail. And a lot of bacteria have this little tail on a flagellum. And when scientists first looked at this under a microscope for the first time, they thought it was a pretty simple thing. But since then, looking at this tail under high-powered microscopes, they've seen that it actually is composed of hundreds of different parts. And this is just like a close-up artist rendition of it. And the thing about this tail is it has irreducible complexity. You need every single part of it for the whole thing to work. Okay. And the reason why this is such a strong argument or strong point for creation is because according to evolution, evolution is small, gradual changes over long periods of time. Okay. But for this tail to have evolved, you would have to have all these hundreds of parts all evolve at the same time in order for it to work. See, there'd be no advantage for this tail to just have like half the parts or some of the parts. It wouldn't be a tail. It would be a non-functioning tail. It would never be an advantage. So according to evolution, you'd have to evolve all those parts simultaneously at the same time, which completely defies evolution. And so for my next, actually, let me show you this slide too. I love this slide. I gave you the mousetrap example, and that's how God could do things. That's kind of like the classic example. But in reality, when God creates something, like I've already mentioned, God creates it with great complexity. So God just doesn't make like a simple mousetrap. He designed something like this board game over here, this mousetrap board game. And I don't know if any of you have played this or know this game, but I made fun of it last time I spoke. It's a crummy game because if you buy this game, and inevitably over time you're going to lose one part, and there's a couple dozen parts, and you have to have all these parts in the right order, and if you're missing just one part, the game will fail to catch the little toy mouse at the end, so it becomes useless. So, and this is how God designed life to be, having great complexity. So, it makes the whole argument of irreducible complexity that much greater for creationists. Okay. So, my next segment that I want to go over and talk about, which I think is a lot of fun, is what I'm calling incredible creatures that defy evolution. And I'm going to use this whole concept of irreducible complexity. That's what I kind of want you to think about as I'm explaining some of these amazing creatures that God has designed for to be here on Earth, okay? And this isn't something that I've come up with. If you Google this on the internet, they have lots of examples. Actually, I believe you could probably actually take any kind of animal, and there's incredible things that God has created about it. But there's some in particular out there that are kind of classic examples that creationists will use to for their argument. So the first one I'm going to present here, it's called the bombardier beetle. This is a not a real beetle here on the picture, on the slide. They actually cut this open so you can see some of the parts inside the abdomen of this beetle here. The bombardier beetle is found in every continent all over the world besides Antarctica. It's even found here in North America. And what makes this creature so incredible is that it actually, it's a defensive mechanism. It can actually have an explosion out its back end there in the face of its predator, okay? And in order for this to happen, listen to what this bombardier beetle has to have. In order for this to happen. And this picture here kind of shows the different chambers and whatnot, okay? It has a chamber in its abdomen lined with an inflammable material similar to asbestos, or else, you know, it'd have to have this, or else it would blow itself up, I guess, or whatever, or the chemicals would kill the insect. It has four different chemicals to make the explosion possible: hydroquinone, hydrogen peroxide, and two different catalysts that all have to mix in a certain order and at a certain time and for the explosion to take place. It has twin tail tubes that direct the direction of fire, which some bombardier beetles can direct the spray over a wide range of directions. And the explosion of the liquid and gas reaches temperatures of a boiling point of water, 212 degrees. And the damage can be fatal to a predator. And actually, like the pictures up here, I don't think it does it quite justice. You can actually go online and look up like videos of it, and it really is like a little mini explosion out the backside of this bug. And the other interesting thing that how God had to create it was, when you watch a video of it in real time, it looks just like one big explosion. But scientists have, if you watch a slow motion video of it, it's actually a sequential explosion out the backside, because if it's just all one big explosion, it actually would blow the bug away. It wouldn't be able to hold on. So it's actually a sequential explosion so that the bug can hang on and not blow itself away at the same time. So just think about that in terms of irreducible complexity, that God would have to create all these different chambers in the abdomen of this beetle for all those chemicals to have evolved at the same time and to mix just right. It completely defies evolution. Okay. All right. So I kind of introduced that whole topic to you and gave you an example of animal. I actually have several more animals, but I have some assistants helping me today, which many of you already have heard this. So first up, I have my daughter, Abigail Lloyd. And you can come on up, Abby. And don't be too distracted by how cute the kids are, because what they're saying, come on up. What they're saying actually does have a very profound point behind it, and that's why I wanted to introduce the concept myself. So, okay, so you can use that microphone right there. It should be on. Thanks, Aaron.
So here is the incubator bird, and it's found in Australia. And what makes this bird so incredible, it's how it builds its nest. First off, the male builds the nest, and it can be up to 20 feet across, 50 feet high, and 6 feet underground. And it can take months to build a nest. Then once the nest is complete, the female comes along to inspect it. And if she rejects it, the male has to start all over again and build a whole new nest. Once a nest is accepted by a female, she lays one egg every 3 days for several months. Each egg is about half a pound each, almost as big as an ostrich egg, which is amazing because the incubator bird is only a 3.5 to 4 pound bird. Once the female lays her eggs, she leaves and the male takes care of the nest. He has to keep the eggs at 91 degrees for 7 months. If the temperature varies by 1 degree, the chicks will die. Every day, the male digs into the nest to check the temperature and humidity. He has to keep it at around 99.5% humidity. If it falls below 80%, the chicks will die. The male can do different things to change the temperature and humidity. He can add things to the nest or take things off. Once the chicks hatch, they are fully feathered and buried deep in the nest. The male doesn't help the chicks get out, and he doesn't care for them at all once they are hatched. Chicks instinctively turn on their back and scrape the mulch off them. And it can take 3 days for the chicks to dig out of the nest. And they leave knowing what to eat, how to eat, where to eat, and they know to come back next year and build a nest without having any instructions. A complete miracle. Also, here's the woodpecker. What makes this bird incredible is how it pecks holes in trees and its incredible tongue, which it uses to eat insects. Its beak is industrial strength, much stronger than the beaks of other birds. It remains perfectly straight for over 10 years and through more than 10 million pecks. Its feet are also interesting, with 2 claws in front and 2 in back, which it uses to climb vertically up a tree. Its tail feathers are also different from those of other birds. They're more resilient, spongy, and tough to brace itself for pecking. There's also a special cartilage between the beak and its skull, which acts as a shock absorber. Its skull is the thickest bone per body pound of any animal. In between pecks, the woodpecker has to open its eyes to focus on what it's pecking, but it also closes its eyes before the next peck because the force is so strong it can pop its eyes out over time. Its tongue can go up to 10 inches out from the beak. The tongue also has special barbs on it and a glue substance that insects stick to. Once the insects are in the woodpecker's mouth, special solvent dissolves the glue. The tongue of the European green woodpecker is really interesting. It starts in the back of the throat, goes out to the back of the head, out a hole in between the eyes, into one of the nostrils, and out of the beak. How did this evolve from another bird? There are no other birds like this. So how in the world could those two birds evolve?
Okay, next is Caroline. You can go stand right up where Abby was.
He was a penguin. What makes a penguin so incredible is how they incubate their eggs and care for their baby chicks. Once the female penguin lays the egg, the male penguin cares for the egg by keeping the egg on its feet tucked up against its stomach. This keeps the egg warm at 95 degrees. The temperature outside in Antarctica can be 100 degrees below zero with 100 mile per hour winds. The males are all together in large flocks, taking turns being at the perimeter and the center of the group, so they can save heat and energy. Meanwhile, the female travels 30 to 40 miles away to the ocean where it stays and eats for 2 months. Meanwhile, the male doesn't eat at all for 2.5 months and loses 40% of its weight. After 2 months, the females know it's time to come back. They can be up to 50 to 60 miles away by this point. They somehow know which male has their egg. They usually find the egg on the very same day it hatches, which is good because they can feed the chick by regurgitating partly digested fish. Scientists are still unsure how it is not raw or been fully digested by this point. After this, all the penguins, including the chicks, make the journey back to the ocean. Here is a giraffe. What makes a giraffe so incredible is how God created it to be so tall. It can be up to 18 feet tall. Now what happens when it bends over to take a drink, or when it bends over and a lion comes along and it has to lift its head quickly? This would normally be a problem, because if you or I were this tall and stood up too quickly, we would pass out. But a giraffe is able to do this because of its enormous heart. It can be up to 2 feet long and weigh 22 pounds. When a giraffe lifts its head, the blood vessels in the head direct almost all the blood flow to the brain, not other parts like the cheek, tongue, or skin. Giraffes also have a complex pressure ridge lacing system in the upper neck to maintain blood flow. And their brains have special elastic blood vessels that connect to one-way valves that prevent the head from swelling. They also have very high blood pressure, two times higher than humans. Their veins have a muscle layer, which is unusual because veins usually do not have muscle. All this is what keeps a giraffe from not passing out when it stands up twitly from taking a drink of water. They have even the blood vessels in the legs would be under great pressure. Most animals wouldn't be able to handle it. But a giraffe has a layer of thick, tight skin on the legs to handle the pressure. NASA scientists are studying this technology and seeing if they can use it in the gravity suits. So how in the world could all of this just have evolved?
Okay, Sophie, your turn.
Here is the hummingbird. What makes the hummingbird so incredible is its amazing design. Hummingbirds are very small. Some come up to only 2 inches long. Hummingbirds can fly in any direction, including backwards. They can also hover in one spot. That's because their wings are attached differently than others. The wings beat up to 80 beats per second. The beaks were designed specially for Pacific flowers. Hummingbirds also migrate. Some migrate all the way from Canada to Mexico. Some even cross the Gulf of Mexico for hundreds of miles, often flying into the wind. Hummingbirds have a very small nest. See how small this nest is? I think it's a hummingbird nest. Hummingbirds are like a car that has nice features. Heated seats, a DVD player that plays movies, music from the radio. But just like a car, these features had to be designed. They could not have happened just by chance. These are glowworms and fireflies. What makes them so incredible is they can produce cold light. Only they can have cold light. We have nothing like it. Cold light uses 100% of the energy for light. The light bulbs in this room only use 4% of the energy for light. The rest is wasted in heat. Cold light is created by two substances mixed together, luciferin and luciferase. Luciferase is an enzyme made up of 1,000 amino acids. Scientists have not been able to duplicate it. So how in the world does all this just have evolved?
And next up is Charlotte Lloyd.
This is a hummingbird. This is a chicken egg. God made chicken eggs an incredible creation from God. There's 10,000 holes in it called pores. That is so the chicken can breathe. If you peel a hard-boiled egg, you'll see a flat spot. flat spot means there's an empty space inside the cell. This is the flat spot right here. Chickens hatch on the 24th day, but they do too big for the egg on the 19th day, so they break a hole in the space, and it gives it 6 hours to breathe, and it uses the 6 hours to break another hole in the cell, and it can't breathe through that hole until 2 days. And on the 24th day, the chick hatches out the egg completely. So how in the world can that possibly all involve?
And then last, I got one more, is Noah Belts.
This is a grizzly bear. It can weigh 900 pounds. This is a polar bear. It can weigh 1,300 pounds. Even though bears are big, God created them to run fast. They can run 30 miles per hour. Mother bears nurse their cubs for 6 months without drinking a drop of water. They also don't go to the bathroom for 6 months while they're nursing. They instead use all that fluid and turn it into milk. Scientists still don't know how they do this. If you or I were in bed for 6 months, we would lose 90% of our muscle mass. But bears only lose 20%. This is because bears will shiver and shake while they hibernate, and this will exercise their muscles. So how in the world could all this have evolved?
That was awesome. Okay, so, and actually, like I said, you could do this with lots of different animals, and there's just a couple more that I want to do myself, and I've got time. So, next up, this is a zipper spider, and they call this a zipper spider because they make a zipper design here in their web. It doesn't act like an actual zipper where it, you know, unzips or anything, but just the design. So they call it a zipper spider because of that. What makes the zipper spider amazing is that it can it actually makes several different types of webbing, not just like one type of webbing, but several different kinds. One type of webbing it has to make is not sticky, and so this is the one that it uses on its web. It can run out on and grab its prey. Another type of webbing is actual sheets of webbing. It shoots out not just like a single strand, but whole sheets of webbing. Another type of webbing is what it uses to make its egg sac, and then the female lays its eggs. And as it lays her eggs, it coats each egg with a special layer of dust so they don't stick together. And then it uses another type of webbing to seal up the egg sac when it's done. Now in the spring, when the eggs hatch, you got all these little baby spiders, and I'm sorry if you got arachnophobia here, but if you got all these little spiders, these little baby spiders, they shoot out another special kind of webbing. And this is really bizarre, but this webbing is designed to get caught up into the wind. So if you have arachnophobia, if you think about like flying spiders, that's even worse. But the spiders actually fly up, and they've actually found these spiders, I guess, 15,000 feet into the sky. And they travel up to 1,500 miles in distance. So that's pretty incredible. I'd have to look up where they are. I don't think Michigan, but I want to say Texas. I want to say they're in Texas.
They're in Wisconsin.
Oh, are they? Okay. Someone's looking it up. Okay, so they might fly over Lake Michigan. Okay, this is the Pacific golden plover. And what makes the plover incredible is in how it migrates and the whole process behind it, okay? So first of all, they lay their eggs up in Alaska. And they're small birds. They only weigh about a half pound each. The female will lay four eggs. And the four eggs, they take approximately 24 days to hatch. And after caring for the chicks for a short period, the plovers, the mothers, they leave the baby chicks behind at that point, and they all migrate. And they migrate, they travel to Hawaii. And with migration, if you ask an evolutionist how does migration happen, what they'll say, the theory behind it is that first it started off with migration very small distances, and over a long period of time, the migration got further and further out. Okay, but they migrate from Alaska to Hawaii, and there's no stops. This is a nonstop flight. Okay, so the first time they had to migrate, you know, it had to be this great distance. Before the mothers set off on the migration, though, they have to put on weight. And it has to gain 70 grams of fat before the migration. And like I said, this is because it's a nonstop flight, and it's an 88-hour flight. It takes 3 days and four nights, and the burn rate is 1 gram of fat per hour. Okay, so if the flight is 88 hours, it needs 88 grams of extra fat to make the flight. And like I said, though, however, it only gains 70 pounds before it takes off, so it should, in theory, then fall short. Except for the fact that they fly in formation and they take turns being at the front to conserve their energy. And so that's how they're able to make the flight there. The other thing that's amazing, though, is remember I said the baby chicks, they stay behind? They stay behind to put on their 70 grams of fat weight gain. And then once they're big enough, they all travel together in a migration. But no one showed them where to go, right? But they just instinctively, something that God, and scientists don't know how, but something that God put in them, they're able to know to fly to Hawaii and land at the same spot. So, pretty amazing. Oh, I forgot that whole slide there, if you missed some of those numbers there. Okay, so this is the vanilla orchid. This is the flower that we get vanilla from. It only blooms one morning out of the year for 2 to 3 hours. And it has a special septum inside that it closes off to the pollen. And only the Melipina bee, I think that's how you say it, Melipina bee, knows how to push away the septum and access the pollen. And so the bee and this orchid have a symbiotic relationship. And there's many examples in nature of symbiotic relationships that this bee and this orchid needed to be created at the same time for both of their existence, okay? So that kind of defies evolution in and of itself. And there's lots of examples of this, of animals that have a symbiotic nature that they need each other in order to survive. Okay, one last example, and this is, this one's got a little different twist. I actually want to start off with going to a scripture here. If you turn to Psalm 22, oh, there's the bee, the Melipina bee. Psalm 22, and actually to start off in verse 1, this whole psalm, if you read it, it's talking about the crucifixion of Jesus. And, of course, the psalm is Old Testament, so it's predicting the crucifixion of Christ about 1,000 years before the actual event. And it starts off in verse 1 saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? And if those words are familiar, it's because in Matthew 27, verse 46, and Mark 15, verse 34, Jesus cried out the same words while he was being crucified. Okay, so go down to Psalm 22 and verse 6, though, and it reads, but I am a worm and no man. Okay, and so this worm is comparable to Jesus, I guess, at this point, being crucified. And if you read the commentaries, they say that Jesus calls himself a worm because it's a term of like severe degradation. It shows his helplessness at this time, that he's miserable, he's defenseless, okay? Which I would agree with all that. But what none of the commentaries have is, because they didn't know at the time of these commentaries, is the life cycle of the worm, or what's going on with the worm, okay? So the word worm here in Hebrew is tolath, okay? Which means crimson worm or scarlet worm. And that's unique or special because normally when you read the word worm in the Bible, in the Hebrew, it's normally rima, which actually means closer to something like a maggot, I guess. So most of the time it's rima. But here in Psalm 22, verse 6, it's tolath, which is crimson worm or scarlet worm. Have you guys heard this before? I'm just curious too. Okay, all right, good, that's good. So this is a picture, actually, of the crimson worm, and I'm guessing, actually, there's more than one of these. I'm guessing all the little red little things that actually look like the plant are various crimson worms. And people often mistake crimson worms for actually being part of the plant itself because it's kind of camouflaged this way. Okay, so let me read the description of what goes on with the crimson worm. When it comes time for the female to have babies, which only happens once in her life, she finds the trunk of a tree, a wooden fence post or a stick. She then attaches her body to that wood and makes a hard crimson shell. She is so strongly and permanently stuck to the wood that the shell can never be removed without tearing her body completely apart or killing her. The crimson worm then lays her eggs under her body and the protective shell. When the baby worms hatch, they stay under the shell, and not only does the mother's body give protection for her babies, but it also provides them with food. The babies feed on the living body of the mother. After just a few days, when the young worms grow to the point that they are able to take care of themselves, the mother dies. And as the mother crimson worm dies, she oozes a crimson scarlet red dye, which not only stains the wood, as you can see here's a picture, stains the wood she has attached to, but also her young children. They are colored scarlet red for the rest of their lives. And then after 3 days, the dead mother, crimson worm's body, loses its crimson color and turns into a white wax, which falls to the ground like a snow. So what makes the whole thing kind of interesting is just like the crimson worm, Jesus sacrificed his life on a tree so that his children might be washed with his crimson blood and their sins cleaned white as snow. He died for us that we might live through him. So I kind of feel like this creature was made specifically for the gospel message, if you will. And I have one more scripture to go along with that. This is Isaiah 1, verse 18. Come now and let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall be as wool. So that's all I have for it. I'm going to stop it there because actually I got quite a bit more like to finish and I don't want to go over. So we'll stop it there. And then next time I'll wrap it up with God's perfect creation, which is man and woman, on day 6. Talk about that. Creation of Sabbath, day 7. And then I have a conclusion to go along with everything to wrap things up and then offer you guys the ultimate proof for creation with that. So, all right. Thank you, everyone. Any comments, questions? Rick?
Yeah, just a couple more quick ones here. The Capistrano Swallows that return to Capistrano, California on exactly the same day every year, I believe it is. And also the one that really blows evolution out of the water is the platypus duck.
Yeah, I could have used the first one you said, but the platypus is one that I looked at too and thought about presenting. Yeah, they find their prey or whatever by using sonar, I believe, because they're blind, and yeah, the whole system's pretty amazing.
Possibly the aardvark.
Anyone else have anything? All right. All right. Oh, Aaron, maybe?
When you started out, you started talking about NASA, and this week I heard an interview, and I don't remember her exact title, but she was director of basically space exploration with the idea of finding, you know, life mm-hmm. on other planets. And that, you know, NASA as a whole, that is their big focus here in the last 5 years. That
oh, sure.
They really...
Just even trying to find it. Water on right. like Mars and yeah, right. all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so when you brought that up, it was the fact that she was just very blunt about the fact this is our goal now. You know, it's mm-hmm. no longer we're chasing after the moon or even just Mars. We're, as a whole, we're looking at all the planets. Mm-hmm. And then you brought up the spiders and Forrest. I don't remember if he was around for us, but 1 year we were on our way down to the feast, and it seems like, I don't know if the Leedys, somebody else we met up or we were trying to meet up with, we stopped at Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And as we entered that area, you know, within a few miles of that area, spider webs kept hitting our car. And we thought that was kind of strange. And when we got out of the parking lot, it was dripping, raining spiders with these webs that were 15, 20 feet long, and they were just floating in the air currents. But, I mean, it was really thick. You would have loved it, Forrest.
I just want to say thanks. I mean, I don't know what you have coming, but this was enough to say, you know, how could that have evolved?
Right,
just
exactly.
like the kids. I mean, it was just really good. Thank you, David, for all your hard work.
And the kids, really, too.
Yeah,
it made it
kids.
Easy on me.
Yeah, thank you, Noah. Thank
You're
you, girls.
All right, we'll sing some songs.
Yeah.